Good afternoon. May it please the court, Steve Capone from Blank Rome, here today on behalf of the defendants below appellants. With me today as well is Mr. William Gatz, the principal as well as Gatz Properties. In connection with this appeal, we're raising primarily three challenges to the trial court's decision. Namely, we believe the court incorrectly interpreted Section 15 of the LLC agreement, which is the contractual provision that is used to review affiliated party transactions, to include fiduciary duties, namely the entire fairness doctrine, as well as the shifting of the burden of proof from the plaintiff to the defendant. Secondly, we believe the court incorrectly construed Chapter 18 of Title 6, the LLC Act, to mandate the application of default fiduciary duties into all LLC agreements. And thirdly, we believe that the LLC being a creature of contract, that the court incorrectly used its equitable powers to fashion a remedy for a perceived breach of fiduciary duty where it should have applied traditional legal principles to determine damages.
Before you get into the first argument, on the first argument, do you believe that the court held that both price as well as process were incorporated in the section of the LLC agreement that you just described, or was it just price?
It was the entirety of entire fairness. So it was price, process, and burden shifting. And the way the opinion gets there is to say the language that says the terms must be comparable with a third party is akin to, I think is the word the Chancellor used, the price prong of entire fairness. And from that, he says price doesn't mean anything unless you have process also evaluated. And then without explanation, he shifts the burden and does not explain how he reaches the burden shifting.
So the answer is both.
Yes.
And process. Now, if he was correct on that as a matter of a hypothetical question, just assume for the purpose of the question he was correct on that, why wouldn't it be correct to determine the damages would flow from the breach on equitable terms rather than strict contract terms?
For the following reason. An LLC is a creature of contract. It is a contract. The relationship is defined by the contract. 1101B of the code says give maximum effect to contract. And even if the parties adopted a contractual standard that used terms akin to fiduciary duties, the damages are still contract-based. I think if you take out the contract element, contract law, and imply fiduciary or common law, you've now taken what is a creature of contract and made it a creature of common law.
But if one were to say that the flexibility exists in maximizing freedom of contract under the LLC statute to expressly or arguably even impliedly place a fiduciary duty on a managing partner in the contract language, even if you didn't use the magic terms fiduciary duty of loyalty, fiduciary duty of care, why wouldn't that be parties agreeing that equitable remedies would apply if that incorporated fiduciary duty were breached?
Chief Justice, in response to that, I'll say this. It may be the case. And I say may because I think the analysis you need to go through, which the Chancellor did not go through, is apply contract principles to say what was the party's intent. Okay. It is not the court's intent. Did the parties intend, when adopting that fiduciary standard for purposes of argument, also intend to have damages determined in something other than a legal way? Here, there was no such discussion, evidence, or determination.
I interrupted you enough. Go ahead with your argument.
Thank you. Section 15, everyone agrees it's the controlling provision. It's a contractual standard. I think it's also agreement that entire fairness was read into Section 15, as well as the shifting of the burden of proof from the plaintiff to the defendant. The question becomes, from where did that authority flow, or from what is the basis for the Chancellor's decision that should be read into Section 15. I submit there is no basis, but if there was, it could come from one of two spots. That's the contract itself, or, as I think what the Chancellor did here, interpret the LLC Act as to require the importation of default fiduciary duties. Absent from the decision below is a complete contract-based analysis as to what did the parties intend. There was no evidence at trial as to their intent on Section 15. There were no findings of fact as to their intent on Section 15. And there's also no finding that this contract was ambiguous, which would have permitted the court to go outside the four corners of the document.
Well, Mr. Jacobs? Section 15 basically you know, precludes a transaction with an affiliate that is less than what would occur if there were an arm's length transaction, that is a market-based price. That really is a long-winded way of describing what is understood in equity as being the fair price component of the duty of loyalty analysis under Weinberger, that is, when there's a conflict transaction. That was, in other words, that, you know, just on a strict contractual basis, the chancellor concluded that fair price was indeed part of the contract, not as a result of any fiduciary duty being, or default fiduciary duty being imported. Secondly, to the extent that you're claiming that he also swept into Section 15 the fair dealing component under the duty of loyalty or Weinberger, I thought that what the chancellor held was simply that the whether or not there was fair dealing is evidentiary toward the issue of whether or not there was fair price, that is, dollar fairness, not that it would be a component of an equitable component that got swept into the contract itself. So I don't understand the argument that he misconstrued Section 15 and didn't apply a contract analysis.
Going to the first part of your question, yes, Section 15 has a terms component, which is what it is. It's the terms of the deal. Is that similar to or analogous to price? Yes. Does price mean that the parties intended price to be the price component of entire fairness? There was no testimony or evidentiary finding that they did. Just because words, again, it's not even price, it's terms equals price.
Well, I think the court found that from the plain language of the contract.
I will not quibble, Justice Jacobs, as to whether or not terms is similar to an analysis you would go through to look at price. It is looking at the terms, the price of the deal. It's the next step, folding in the process. The parties did not say price and process, and I would argue that it's a safe harbor provision that focuses on an objective standard of terms for a reason. It was deliberate. It was to avoid a subjective analysis.
I understand, but whether or not there was fair dealing can bear on the question of whether there is dollar fairness in the transaction price. And I thought that was what the chancellor was saying. In other words, he wasn't using fair dealing as an element, as a separate component of the test for purposes of contractual liability, but only saying that the existence or non-existence of fair dealing would bear on whether or not the price is fair under Section 15.
I would respectfully disagree. I think if you read the decision, it's very clear that he starts off by saying, the chancellor starts off by saying, this is akin to the fair price component. He says price is meaningless without process. When you also overlap into that he shifted the burden of proof, that is the entirety of entire fairness. He may not have held or said in one sentence, I'm applying entire fairness, but he applied entire fairness. Secondly,
entire fairness, full blown?
Full blown, all in, he applied entire fairness. Secondarily, the parties chose their measuring stick, and it was terms. It was not terms and process. And I think under the RSM Alliance line of thought, when the parties dictate their own measuring stick, that is the one the courts are to use in a contract and not to supplement it. And so
if we agree with you that on the burden of proof that should not have been incorporated into the mix, that shifting, wouldn't the outcome of the case still be the same, given the other prospective buyer?
Reading the future, the only answer I could give you that is an honest answer is I don't know, but what I can say is when you use the wrong standard, the findings of fact are meaningless. It is a prism through which you look at the evidence. The evidence is someone did something. You apply a legal standard to reach conclusions of law and finding of fact. It is why, for example, in the Superior Court, the jury's charged with the wrong legal standard, entirely new case is set. As an analogy, if we could all agree that a car is going down the highway 55 miles an hour, if the legal standard to which you view that evidence is, it's a school zone, the speed limit is 15, you could conclude he's a reckless driver. If the speed limit and the law is 65, you would say he's a cautious driver. So the prism through which you view the facts can get you to polar opposite conclusions. Under the appropriate facts, legal standard, a finer fact may reach ultimately the same conclusion. But here, Mr. Gatz and Gatz Properties were guilty, using a criminal analogy, before they walked into the courtroom because the burden had been shifted. Had they not put on any evidence, they had lost. And I think that skews all the factual findings in this case. Sorry, Justice Jacobs?
Burden of proof is, you know, basically is defined as what occurs when the evidence on an issue is in equipoise. The party with the burden of proof loses. I thought what the Chancellor held here is that the evidence was not in equipoise. I mean, to the extent that the issue was evidentiary.
Yeah, Justice Jacobs, I think how you view the evidence, how you perceive something, is the standard you apply. The court, the Chancellor, clearly felt that Mr. Gatz was a faithless fiduciary because he found that he had fiduciary obligations, and before the trial start had concluded that he'd already breached those duties. It was his burden to prove that he did not. It's fundamental to how the process works. I also think it's fundamental to a contract dispute. Parties to a contract, one that alleges the breach, has the burden of showing it was breached. It's not the party who's accused does not come in two strikes down. And I think that, getting to Justice Ridgely's point, if you apply the wrong standard, you can get the wrong results. That happens all the time in the Superior Court, and that's why cases get remanded to a new jury who then looks at the facts through the correct legal prism. And I think that fundamentally is what happened here with Section 15. By adopting an entire fairness standard and shifting the burden, it converted what was, I believe, a safe harbor provision into a presumption of guilt provision, presumptively disfavoring affiliated party transactions. And the reason I say that is entire fairness, going back as far as Nixon v. Blackwell and since then, has been noted as the most onerous standard under Delaware law. And also, it's routinely found to be a standard that ordinarily results in liability. So if you read entire fairness into Section 15, it now becomes a provision where it's presumptive that affiliated transactions are improper or disfavored. I don't think that's a fair reading of Section 15. Had the parties wanted to make affiliated transactions improper or limited, they would have done so directly. They would have said, you may not do this, or you may only do this if approved by the other members of the LLC. And so I think what the Chancellor did was improperly convert a safe harbor, getting into a presumption of liability. Going to a pure contract analysis here, absent a finding of ambiguity, absent a finding as to the party's intent, I don't think looking strictly at the wording of Section 15, one can intellectually get to a finding of the shifting of the burden in entire fairness. Chief Justice, maybe had there been a finding of the party's intent, you could get there to support it, but I don't think this opinion gets us that far.
To what extent does the testimony of the parties, as it appears in the record, touch on the party's intent? Are we limited, in other words, to reading the document, or can we look at the testimony and conclude from that testimony that a party believed that they had undertaken fiduciary duties?
With respect to the interpretation of Section 15, absent a finding of ambiguity, you're limited to the wording of Section 15, and to the extent you can divine the party's intent by looking at the four corners of the document, you can do that, and that's part of my argument. If that had the parties intended to put a provision in there prohibiting affiliated party transactions, we find other evidence of that in this document. To go to the party's testimony, it's extrinsic parole evidence. There was no finding of ambiguity. I don't think it's proper to take it into consideration. That being said, there was no testimony as to the drafting history, the party's intent, whether they wanted to shift the burden or have the fair process prong brought into this provision.
Did Mr. Gatz testify that he believed he owed fiduciary duties to the investors?
Mr. Gatz testified that he owed he could be subject to fiduciary duties under the LLC agreement, but not with respect to Section 15. It was always steadfastly maintained that Section 15 was a self-contained standard. To the extent one would even be permitted to imply fiduciary duties, that Section 15, by adopting its own standard, would preclude the applicator reading into that language implied fiduciary duties.
Well, did the section bar exculpation for gross negligence?
Section 16 barred exculpation for gross negligence, not Section 15.
What does that say to us about the extent to which the managers owed fiduciary duties to the investors, if anything?
I think it says nothing. You don't get to 16 unless you are found to have breached some other provision of the agreement. Absent a breach, exculpation is a non-factor. It is simply the parties put in a heightened bar to be relieved of a breach, but I don't think you can use the standard for relieving you of a breach to now become the standard for determining whether there's a breach.
Okay. Does that commit you then that there was, in fact, a fair price paid for the entity?
Sorry, I'm not sure I follow your question.
Are you committed to the fact that there was a fair price paid for the entity? Is that your position?
Our position
at the end of the auction, it was a fair price?
At the end of the auction, it was a fair price. And we get there because, A, it was an auction, B, the testimony at trial, including the testimony of Mr. Carr, was that no one would pay more. This company was simply not worth its debt. The mortgage on this property exceeded the value of the entity. And that's why no one wanted to bid or seek to acquire the entity. One last, before I move on, unless of course further questions on the Section 15, I think clearly there may be a struggle between the Chancellor's findings as to whether or not the process.
Before you leave Section 15, I gather that your side's position is, yes, there were default fiduciary duties that were retained in the LLC agreement, except for paragraph 15 or Section 15. Is that fair?
No, it's not, Justice Jacobs. We do not believe that there are default fiduciary duties. We believe you can read. By way of a little background, there was no discussion at trial, pretrial, post-trial, so this concept of how you interpret.
Was it conceded that there are, forget, but let's strike the word default, that there are fiduciary duties embedded in this LLC agreement except for Section 15?
That point, yes, Justice Jacobs, specifically Section 16, which the Chief Justice referenced.
Okay. Section 15, which you say excludes proscribes, whatever the right word is, fiduciary duties, does not explicitly do that.
It does not expressly say no fiduciary duties apply, but I think under the jurisprudence in this state, when you do prescribe the standard, that is the standard to be applied. And I think to require parties to say not only what they intend, but every possibility of what they may not intend into every clause of a contract, it would go on indefinitely. With regard to the issue of the default fiduciary duties, which is ultimately what I believe the Chancellor relied upon to find the justify the ability to apply entire fairness in Section 15.
Did the Chancellor have to go there? Could this case not have been decided based on the statutory or based on the language in the LLC agreement? Why did he go to this whole diatribe, for lack of a better word, about how ignorant people are who think other than he does about whether the default position is fiduciary duties apply or don't apply? And then vacillate back and forth between a statutory analysis and an equitable analysis in what I find to be a highly confusing way of approaching it. Could he have stopped with the LLC language analysis and ended the case?
The answer to your question, I believe, I will say, answers the questions from the panel to date. And the answer is yes, if you read Section 15 the way the defendants read Section 15. No, if you want to find liability. I think the answer is in the opinion itself. The Chancellor felt the need to go through that entire analysis because it was the only way to justify entire fairness and burden shifting into Section 15. There had been no discussion at trial or in the post-trial briefing as to how to interpret Section 18. That was something new that was interjected by the Chancellor when he issued his opinion. And I believe...
Did he inject default fiduciary duties as well?
Yes. That was in the argument, the discussion through the case had always been arbitrary fiduciary duties but focused on the agreement. There was never briefing or analysis or argument on how you interpret the LLC Act and whether that mandates the importation.
So he reached a conclusion without considering all the arguments pro and con that have been raised in this appeal.
They were not argued. And again, I believe he was required or felt the need to go there in order to find liability. I think that is, I would agree with Chief Justice, it is a confusing opinion. It's very difficult to determine, is this a factual finding, is this a contractually based finding, or is this an equitable finding? It's all sort of intertwined in there, and it makes it hard to separate it out. I think had the Chancellor adopted our interpretation, that would have ended the inquiry.
All right, so I gather in response to the Chief Justice's question, you're saying that if you put for Section 15 to one side for a moment, then it really wasn't necessary for the Chancellor to interpret whether or not the statute permitted or envisions default fiduciary duties, because it was already conceded that this LLC agreement had those duties embedded, at least except for Section 15, correct?
No, Justice Jacobs. Again, to be very clear, the discussion had always been focused on the LLC agreement. Mr. Gatz conceded that this agreement, the four corners of this document, particularly Section 16, could create a fiduciary duty. There was never a discussion about the wholesale default or whatever that word is. The party's contract in 16 had a fiduciary element. 15, we always steadfastly maintain, had no fiduciary element.
I think you're agreeing with what I'm saying.
Maybe I don't understand the question. I apologize.
Okay. If the, since Mr. Gatz conceded that the LLC agreement embedded fiduciary duties, included them, except for paragraph 15. To that extent, it was unnecessary for the Chancellor to interpret the statute, the LLC statute, on the issue of whether or not there are default fiduciary duties.
I would agree. And again, the only reason I believe he felt the need to do so.
So your point, though, is that Section 15 excludes fiduciary duties, doesn't include them, and therefore for the court to come out the way it did, the court necessarily had to find, A, that there were default fiduciary duties under the statute and that they were embedded in 15 as well as the rest of the agreement. Is that your point?
That is exactly our position, which I believe is essentially William Penn Partners, the opposite of William Penn Partners, where this court found that the parties agreed that the fiduciary duties existed, therefore did not have to address the issue.
Did you want to save the balance of your time for
rebuttal? Yes, sorry, I would like to. Thank you.
May it please the court, John Reed for the plaintiffs. If it's all right with the court, what I would like to do is discuss what I think are some of the critical facts that put the case in context, and then address essentially four legal arguments in the following order. That is, one, whether or not the defendants even have the right to make an argument to this court that fiduciary duties do not apply to the LLC agreement or to Mr. Gatz as the manager. Number two, whether in their reply brief, responding to our waiver argument, they have made outright misrepresentations. Three, assuming we get to the issue of fiduciary duties, and since the court is not going to rule ahead of time, I'm going to have to cover it, whether or not, absent an express invocation, default fiduciary duties apply to LLCs. And then I would like to conclude with the discussion of damages and why, whether you look at this in a fiduciary context or a contract context, in light of the provisions in this agreement, none of this really matters, particularly based upon the findings of fact that were made. So the defendants do not challenge any of the facts on appeal. They state that expressly on page 10 of their reply brief. So let's look for a moment at the most egregious acts of bad faith by Mr. Gatz. He refused to provide basic due diligence information to an interested buyer, that was RDC. Even without the request, RDC expressed an interest in buying this company in an amount greater than $6 million. After being frustrated in not getting any kind of response, RDC walked away, demoralized. What did Mr. Gatz do next? He turned around and tried to buy the minority out for a price less than $6 million, never disclosing RDC's expression of interest in a buyout greater than $6 million. When the majority rejected the proposal, what did he do? He turned around, threatened to sue them. Or when the minority rejected the proposal, he turned around, threatened to sue them, using his personal counsel to represent both him and the company at the same time. He eventually puts the company up for auction in late, the discussions with RDC started in late 2007, all this pursued over a course of months. He eventually puts the company up for auction in late 2008, using what the court found to be an inexperienced and unqualified auctioneer, and never bothered to contact RDC, somebody who would have been one of the likely buyers. Now, because Mr. Gatz destroyed his communications with RDC and never produced them in discovery, we only through luck were able to find out about the interest, and through the use of a commission and a subpoena, were able to obtain those documents. And so to this day, we have no idea whether there are other interested parties out there that we don't know anything about because we weren't able to independently pursue them. So let me summarize what the economics of this situation are for the minority. The minority came into this with an $800,000 investment. The defendant came in this with land. During the life of this company, the minority had to pay taxes on income generated by the company, but no distributions were ever made, so they wound up paying income on money they never received. During the life of the company, the defendant received over $1 million for management fees. Now, nobody begrudges that. That's what he was entitled to under the contract. The sale of the company ended as follows. The plaintiffs, for their $800,000, wound up with $28,000. Mr. Gatz, he got his land back, unencumbered. He received $22,000, which was his share of the $50,000 that he paid for the company. Plus, he got $1.6 million in cash that was in the company's bank account on the date of the auction. Mr. Gatz is the definition of a faithless fiduciary and a bad actor, both as a manager and as a litigant, as a consequence of destroying the documents and never disclosing the interest of that third-party buyer. That is why the trial court awarded the damages that it did. That is why the trial court shifted half the fees. Now, the first key argument that the defendants make on appeal is that the trial court should be reversed because fiduciary duties do not apply to the LLC agreement. Now, we point out in our brief, and I'd like to delve into it a little bit more at argument because I think it's important to understand this. They waived this argument multiple ways from the beginning through the end of the proceedings below. In the answer to the complaint, they admitted that Mr. Gatz was manager of the company and, quote, owed fiduciary duties as a result thereof. Now, an allegation in a complaint that a manager of an LLC owes fiduciary duties can be answered a number of ways. You can say admitted or denied. You can say states a legal conclusion. Or you can say states a legal conclusion. However, to the extent it alleges that the intent of the parties was for fiduciary duties to apply to this agreement, admitted or denied. They just gave an outright admission. They said the admission is, quote, fiduciary, he owes, quote, fiduciary duties. That's duties with an S, multiple. As far as I'm aware, there are only two fiduciary duties, care and loyalty. At that point, this issue of fiduciary duties should have been over. The record doesn't end there, however. In the opening pretrial brief, they argued that the defendant fully complied with his fiduciary duties, to B66 in the record. In their answering pretrial brief, they said, quote, to be absolutely clear, defendants are not arguing that the LLC agreement waives all fiduciary duties. In the issues of law and fact that remain to be litigated in the pretrial order that was submitted to the court, nowhere. If you look at the defendant section, which is B129 to B132 in the record, nowhere will you find preservation of that issue. And of course, as the court discussed with Mr. Capone during trial, in response to direct questions the defendant himself admitted, so now we're at the end of the proceeding, in response to the following question, would you agree Gatz Properties owe fiduciary duties to the members of Peconic Bay? The answer was an unequivocal yes. And you understood that you personally had a fiduciary duty to all members of Peconic Bay, right? Answer, yes. This is at B157 of the record. both the plaintiffs, we relied the minute we received an answer that said they admitted fiduciary duties apply. We relied on the fact that fiduciary duties would apply to this case. The chancellor relied upon what they said in their briefs and even cited it in his opinion at page 27 to 28 in footnote 67. Now, the response to all of this is quite curious. They start off on page 12 of their reply brief. And I'll give them credit. I don't believe this is a frivolous argument or a misrepresentation, the way they get started. This is what they say. Defendants have never conceded that contractual or default common law fiduciary duties apply to an evaluation of Section 15 affiliate transactions. Rather, defendants have argued and continue to argue that any applicable fiduciary duties are displaced by the standards set forth in Section 15. Now, if Section 15 displaced fiduciary duties, which they admitted apply, and would therefore have to apply in order for them to, in the first instance, in order for them to be displaced, then the waiver of fiduciary duties to Section 15 ought to be express, or at least be clear. And it's not. As Justice Jacobs pointed out, essentially Section 15 is a fair price provision. All it says is you cannot engage in an affiliate transaction unless it's on terms which could be entered into with arm's length third parties, unquote. It doesn't waive fiduciary duties for purposes of carrying out your responsibilities or invoking Section 15. The arguments go downhill from here. On page 13 of the reply brief, defendants say,
well, you've characterized Section 15 as a fair price provision.
Yes, Your Honor.
It is not then an entire fairness provision.
Well, I think that it tracks essentially the fair price, and even perhaps if you accept the argument or the assumption that fiduciary duties apply throughout the responsibilities under the agreement, it would be both a fair price and a fair process provision, because it precludes...
That's not the way the Chancellor analyzed it in his opinion. Isn't that right?
I agree with that. He looked at it from a fair price provision.
Right.
And I will acknowledge that the opinion does go back and forth as it's discussing the facts, and so it's discussing equity and discussing the contract provisions and discussing, you know, the duty of good faith and good faith under the agreement. Just remember, there was a count in this case for breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. So, yes, he goes into a lot of that, and I intend to discuss that at the end as to why that doesn't matter based upon the evidentiary record. But what they say at page 13 of their reply brief is particularly important, if not confusing, however. They say that when they admitted fiduciary duties apply, they, quote, merely reemphasized that certain provisions in the LLC agreement may impose fiduciary duties. See, for example, Section 16 that they cite. Now, that argument, as far as I can tell, is just made up for the reply brief. And the reason I say that, in the opening brief that they filed with this court, they said Section 16 is irrelevant. It's simply an exculpatory provision, and you never get to it. This will be at pages 19 to 20 of their opening brief. You never get to it unless you find an independent breach. But now, when they're called onto the carpet that they waive fiduciary duties and we point out all the provisions, portions of the record where they did, they come back and say, well, when we said that, we were referring to things like Section 16 as an example. Now, that's
When you say they waive fiduciary duties, you mean they waive the argument that fiduciary duties don't apply.
Correct, Your Honor. They waive the argument. That's right.
I just want to make sure
yes.
I understood that.
So now they're saying the opening brief says Section 16 doesn't. Now they say Section 16 is an example of when they're admitting that when they say fiduciaries apply, Section 16 is an example. And now, 15 minutes ago, Mr. Capone reverted back to the argument in front of this court that he made in the opening brief. So I'm not sure. Is their position that Section 16 independently creates fiduciary duties, and that's what they were admitting to, and that's what they were talking about when they said in the briefs they filed below fiduciary duties apply, or does it not create any duties at all, and it's a pure standalone exculpatory provision that doesn't get invoked unless Section 15 is implicated? It's very hard to tell. If you stay on page 13 of the reply brief, this part I had difficulty comprehending. It says, admitting that certain fiduciary duties apply, though, this is quote, admitting that certain fiduciary duties apply, though, does not amount to an admission that contractual or default fiduciary duties apply. Now, it's my understanding that fiduciary duties, whether applied at common law or by contract or by default, they're the same fiduciary duties, care and loyalty. When you admit that they apply. And of course, this now brings me to what I think is the worst part of this case. And it's one I honestly feel uncomfortable talking about. It's on page 14 of their reply brief. And they state that the issue of default fiduciary duties, quote, was not raised because the trial court specifically warned defendants not to do so or face sanctions for raising what the trial court deemed a frivolous argument, unquote. They then repeat this same argument in the middle of page 14 of their reply brief. And then they say a very disturbing thing in footnote 3, quote, defendants are unable to cite or attach the transcripts of the pretrial conference or the additional colloquies of the trial court related to these statements, as all were conducted off the record at the direction of the trial court. So what the defendants have told this court is that the head of the leading business trial court in this country deprived them of due process by threatening them out of not to make an argument that was a key argument in their case. Now, can the truth be determined by the record? I submit that it can be. The pretrial conference, just look at the record, look at the docket that's been provided to the court. The pretrial conference took place on October 19, 2011. 8 days prior to the pretrial conference on August 11th, defendants filed their answering pretrial brief in which they said, to be absolutely clear, we're not arguing that the LLC agreement waives fiduciary duties. But more importantly, 3 days prior to the pretrial conference, on August 16th, they filed their joint pretrial stipulation and order. And as I mentioned before, nowhere in there will you find this issue of default fiduciary duties or an argument that fiduciary duties doesn't apply as an issue to be decided at trial. Now, defendants would have had to know when they were preparing their pretrial order by looking through their crystal ball that 3 days later they were going to be threatened about not making an argument, and therefore they kept it out. When they showed up on August 19th for that pretrial conference, they weren't allowed to make that argument anymore. They didn't even put it in their pretrial order. I was at the pretrial conference, and I think this is probably irrelevant, but I want to, for the record, defend the chancellor. I can tell you flat out my recollection of what occurred. He essentially said to the defendants, you have a problem on liability, and he looked at me and said the damages could be zero. And then he said, however, if the parties want me to decide this case, I will do my constitutional duty and I will decide this case. And he did. Now, this is an outright attack on the chancellor to say that he threatened them out of making these arguments when it's easily provable by the look at the timing of the pretrial order that they weren't threatened out of making an argument that they already hadn't preserved 3 days earlier. I think it's sanctionable conduct. I think it's conduct that maybe even goes beyond the issue of sanctions and calls into question.
Let's assume for a moment that you state a case for what you just proposed. What does it have to do with the appeal?
Well, Your Honor, the point I'm trying to make is they shouldn't even be permitted. Our position is that this appeal is frivolous to the extent that they're raising this fiduciary duty argument. They waived it as a procedural matter. They waived it in briefs. They waived it through their own witness at trial. They waived it by never preserving it in the pretrial order. And then the central argument is, oh, the chancellor, he just got it all wrong. They shouldn't even be allowed to raise this issue on appeal. The one thing I will agree with is the chancellor could have decided this case without going through that lengthy discussion about whether default fiduciary duties apply or not. But he did.
And that was not in response to any argument.
No, it wasn't argued below. I mean, this whole argument is just...
It wasn't argued by either side below.
Correct.
It's just the law review portion of his opinion.
Correct. Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I'm prepared to argue this issue. But I will tell you, I don't believe an important issue like this ought to be argued unless it's subjected to a vigorous adversarial process below. And it wasn't in this case. So, I mean, I would rely upon what we said in our briefs. I addressed it in the briefs because I felt I had to. But I think that, I don't feel like I even have a stake in it. I don't think it ought to have to be argued. I will say this. I'll make a policy comment about it to the extent the court's interested in hearing the argument. I'm not a subscriber to the notion that because the Court of Chancery has repeatedly decided an issue one way, that and practitioners have accepted it, that this court, when it finally gets its hands on the issue, somehow ought to be constrained because people have been conforming their conduct to what the Court of Chancery has done. I mean, if this court thinks the Court of Chancery got something wrong, I think this court ought to reverse, and I think this court would reverse. I would point out a distinction here, though, that ought to be kept in mind, and that is the statute was later amended in the face of an interpretation that default fiduciary duties applied in order to allow, make it clear in the statute that you could expressly waive fiduciary duties. And in light of the legislature's acceptance of what the court had said, and then the invocation of the waiver provision in 1101C, I think a lot of folks out there have conformed their conduct based upon at least how the legislature reacted.
Well, the one thing we know is that the opinion says that's what's happened, but there's not one iota of empirical data to support that conclusion in the record.
I would agree with that as well. That I would agree with. I mean, all we have is the timing of when the legislature amended the act and the fact that we know from the Secretary of State's filings the number of folks that form LLCs. We don't know what their thinking is or so forth. I will definitely acknowledge that.
You're down to about 5 minutes. Did you want to touch on your damage argument?
I do. It's good because I'm just right to the last page of the argument and ready to confront it. So we alleged breach of fiduciary duty claims, breach of contract claims, breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. You know, it's clear that Section 15 parallels loyalty. It prohibits you from engaging in a self-dealing transaction. It's clear that Section 16 preserves liability for gross negligence, bad faith, and misrepresentation, and therefore parallels the duty of care and parallels the duty of loyalty as well in that regard with regard to misrepresentations. Even if you view this case solely as a contract case, and solely with the burden on the plaintiffs, all of the evidence in this record points in favor of the plaintiffs. I have no idea. I can't point to you to one factual finding in the opinion that would support an argument that Mr. Gatz complied with Section 15. We have a conclusion that the auctioneer's testimony was embarrassing, quote, embarrassing, to page 55 of the opinion, and the auctioneer was unqualified, to use the chancellor's words, that's at page 54. It's undisputed and found that RDC was never contacted throughout this process. And so there's no way Mr. Gatz can make an argument upon any fact in the record that he bought this company at a price that was one that could have been that was at least equal to one that could have been achieved in a third-party arm's length transaction. The damages, whether you view this as a contract or fiduciary damages case, the damages are the same, and that is we were entitled to have the company bought out at a price that would have been at least the equivalent, no less than one that would have been obtained in an arm's length third-party transaction. And that's all that is consequential damage. That's actually that's direct damages arising right out of a breach of the contract. Because that's exactly what Mr. Gatz did. He bought this company on self-dealing terms and not terms that satisfied the contract provision. But again, I think that's a worst case scenario for us. Because if you view it purely with regard to contract, and you have to go through the evidence, I think the chancellor got it right. I think the chancellor, it was appropriate for the chancellor to rely upon the admission in the answer and the repeated representations that Mr. Gatz owed fiduciary duties. And once you admit you owe fiduciary duties, you owe fiduciary duties. You know, the argument that I would have made on appeal is the issue of whether or not the entire fairness burden shifting, which this court has created in the world of corporate law, should apply in the world of LLCs. But none of that was ever argued below. And I would make one last comment about the damage award. And I think the court needs to understand, I mean, this appeal is expensive. The minority here, you know, went to great lengths, not just to prove their case, but to have to go get documents that were destroyed, and now have to come up and confront an argument that was never preserved on appeal. You know, I'm not an advocate for the argument that, you know, just because you demonstrate a breach of fiduciary duty that you ought to get fees. This goes well beyond a breach of fiduciary duty. This is a bad faith actor. This is a bad faith litigant. This is bad faith counsel making these arguments and saying the things that they said about the chancellor. And some of these things are lawyer-driven arguments, not client-driven arguments. And I think the court ought to, just like the court did in the William Penn case, where the court emphasized the importance of making plaintiffs whole, particularly in cases where there's not a lot of damage at stake. What you don't want is a fiduciary to say, you know what, I'll squeeze the minority. There's not that much at stake. They can't afford to pursue me. Because if they do, the result is going to be zero. As the court knows from what's been filed in this court, the defendant in this case, not Mr. Gatz, but the Gatz Properties, filed for bankruptcy. One of the key claims in the bankruptcy estate, discussed in what's been filed with the court, is a malpractice claim against the lawyers. Now, how wonderful would that be for the defendant, the faithless fiduciary or the bad actor, to keep the benefit of his bargain and then have his judgment, all his fees for, paid by his counsel in a malpractice action, and the poor innocent minority are stuck because they've lost a war of attrition because their fiduciary or their manager under the contract didn't just, you know, drop the ball, but misrepresented things to them, destroyed documents, forced them to come up to this court and argue issues that were never argued below. I respectfully suggest that the court ought to affirm the opinion below and give serious consideration to awarding the fees for this appeal, and not just by the defendant, but by the counsel that made these arguments and made the attacks upon the chancellor that I discussed. Thank you.
Listening to Mr. Reed's comments makes me wonder why the chancellor issued a decision at all, because apparently my client conceded everything from the outset of the case. On the issue of waiver, proof is in the pudding. The chancellor issued an 80-some page of decision, 20-some pages of a legal analysis, goes through painstakingly whether or not fiduciary duties apply, whether or not they apply in this case, and whether or not they apply to Mr. Gatz. That's because it was at issue at the entirety of the case. I think had there been the kind of blanket waiver that is argued, one would then have to conclude that the chancellor basically hijacked this case to do nothing but write a law review article. Because had fiduciary duties been conceded, it simply would have been, as in William Penn Partners, fiduciary duties were conceded, I need not address this issue, now let's look at the facts. That is not what the chancellor did, because that is not what happened below. More importantly, the chancellor did not find a waiver.
Well, do you have counter sites to the record that Mr. Reed referred us to?
The counter sites, I don't challenge the citations to the record, as I've explained. We conceded that the LLC agreement provisions other than 15 may include fiduciary duties, but never conceded that fiduciary duties apply to affiliated party transactions under Section 15. The issue of default fiduciary duties, again, had not been raised below, was raised by the court, the chancellor, which I think is completely appropriate to address on appeal that issue. And again, I believe that issue was raised because the chancellor knew he had to go there in order to justify his reading of Section 15. Briefly, on the issue of the pretrial conference, it was raised in our, these allegations of conduct on counsel, not making any allegations that we were threatened or pressured, simply stated, the chancellor made it very clear that he had reached a conclusion on that point and that we should focus our energies in other directions, so we did. That is why in our post-trial answering brief, there's a preface which says, we heard you, we won't relitigate these issues or re-argue these points, we're going to address the issues that you say we should focus on.
Well, what point was it that you were not going to, you were not allowed to relitigate?
At the pretrial conference, the chancellor made it clear that he thought it was bad faith argument to say there were not inherent fiduciary duties, and throughout the course of the trial, reiterate that. Then the last day of trial, we were getting ready for briefing, said, I want briefs due in X period of time, and I want to reiterate that if you make bad faith arguments like that, I'm going to deem them to be sanctionable because it's going to be a waste of everyone's time and energy to respond to them.
That's why. You're saying none of that's on the record?
The chancellor's trying frequently dispensed advice to the parties throughout the course of the case that was off the record. And that's why in our brief, we have that notation that we heard your statements and we are not going to re-argue that point and incur sanctions. We sanctioned anyway, but we were trying to pay homage to the courts. We didn't just make that up. That was in response to direct comments from the court. But in any respect, I don't view that as a threat. Never alleged it was a threat. It was simply an acknowledgement on our part. The court had reached its conclusion. Someone on this bench were to say they made their mind up on a point, I won't belabor it.
Okay, you're out of time, I'm sorry to say.
Sorry, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Rise.